Today is Thursday, May 10th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, three Americans detained in North Korea return home.
I appreciate Kim Jong-un doing this and allowing them to go.
Tensions are heightened after President Trump pulls the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal. The president's nominee to head the top intelligence agency is grilled by lawmakers. Also ahead, an Egyptian woman launches an online radio show to help divorcees. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump said the date and location of his summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will be announced in a matter of days, but it will not occur at the Korean demilitarized zone, as he had previously suggested. Trump made the remarks to reporters at the White House Wednesday shortly after North Korea freed three American detainees. The Korean Americans headed home with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who met with Kim again. Trump said he and Vice President Mike Pence would be on hand to greet the freed Americans.
To me, it's very exciting because it represents something. It represents something very important to this country.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Eric Gladstein, Chief Strategy Officer of the Human Rights Foundation.
Well, first and foremost, we're just very grateful and happy to see the prisoners released. We can only hope they are in good health and that what happened to Otto Warmbier did not happen to them.
How do you think this release figures in to what is to come, at least we think is to come, and that is the talks between Trump and Kim?
Well, it's quite clear that, you know, this is a strategic move by the North Korean dictatorship to help buy them a little bit more time, to help give them a little more leverage. And, you know, their goal, of course, is to prolong and sustain their rule. And I think what's really important for people to look back at is the Sunshine Policy and the six-party talks. We have a lot of evidence here that tells us and shows us what the North Korean dictatorship does after and during, you know, and as a result of quote-unquote talks with other countries. And, you know, the results are in and they're clear, and the results are that the human rights situation inside North Korea and the war, the real war on the Korean Peninsula between the North Korean government, you know, and waged on its people does not end. And that these talks end up over, you know, the ones we've seen, at least, these talks end up bailing out, rescuing, strengthening this really evil government. And we've seen that happen several times in the last few decades.
Do you?
And what happens is the human rights conditions on the ground in North Korea do not get any better.
Do you believe that Kim Jong-un is seriously trying to change his stance as far as how he and his country relate to other countries?
No. Fundamentally, no. I believe you will see Kim Jong-un potentially sell or give away some of the weapon technology, potentially to China. I believe it'll be impossible to verify whether he gives away all of it. I believe you'll see conditions whereby if they do certain things, if they pledge to stop testing, if they pledge to give up some of their weapons, you'll see sanctions reduced, and you'll see a lot of money flowing towards the Kim regime, which is, of course, exactly what they want.
Do you think that the U.S. agenda in these talks have anything to do with human rights or the prisoners that are being incarcerated in North Korea?
My hope is yes, and there is some hope for that based on the fact that Ji Sung-ho, a remarkable North Korean defector, was celebrated at the President's State of the Union address a few months ago. And that both the president and vice president seem to be sympathetic to the suffering of the North Korean people. But my expectation, unfortunately, is that no, at these talks and the result of these talks will not feature or advance any sort of human rights promotion for the North Korean people.
All right, that's Alex Gladstein, Chief Strategy Officer of the Human Rights Foundation. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The Malaysian ex-prime minister stuns the world by returning to power at 92 years old. Europe vows to defend its interest in Iran. Medical teams work to contain an Ebola outbreak in DRC. And Malawi tackles rabies one dog at a time. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The Israeli military says Iranian forces fired 20 rockets at Israeli army posts in the Golan Heights from inside Syria early Thursday. It said its Iron Dome missile defense system intercepted some of the rockets, while the others caused minimal damage and no casualties. Syrian state media also reported that Israeli missiles hit military bases inside Syria, as well as an arms depot and radar installation, while claiming air defenses brought many of the missiles down. Israeli intelligence has said it anticipated possible Iranian action after President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the nuclear agreement with Iran. And Trump said on Wednesday continued on Wednesday to have strong words about the Iran deal.
So we're going to make either a really good deal for the world, or we're not going to make a deal at all. And Iran will come back and say, we don't want to negotiate. And of course, they're going to say that. And if I were in their position, I'd say that, too, for the first couple of months. We're not going to negotiate, but they'll negotiate. Or something will happen.
VOA's Victor Beatty asks Hussein Binai, assistant professor of the International Studies at Indiana University, for reaction to the whole situation and the U.S. withdrawal from the deal.
The decision itself was obviously not surprising. Trump had campaigned on withdrawing from the nuclear deal. Nevertheless, it's still very shocking because of just what primarily this will do to arms control in the Middle East, in that it frees Iran basically of the obligations that it has made under the terms of the agreement. If one of the parties to the agreement withdraws, then Iran can go back to the status quo ante.
How likely will Iran do that, do you think?
It's unlikely at the moment because the Iranians have a great deal of vulnerabilities that they have to think about. They had primarily used the program as a way to negotiate their way back into the international community, if you will. They had been in the isolation booth for much of the life of the Islamic Republic since 1979. And this was a way really for them to get attention and to basically give up something in order to be accepted in the community of nations, primarily through economic relations with Western Europe. So they are still keen on staying in that deal because the Iranian economy is in a very vulnerable place and they would need those trade ties with the Europeans. So I think they are kind of taking a wait-and-see approach to see just how the Europeans are going to maneuver the latest data point in U.S.-Iran relations and whether they're going to offer up guarantees that the Americans obviously are not able to.
With the U.S. out, can the Europeans salvage the deal?
It's possible that they would work out a parallel agreement just signed between Iran and the four European countries plus Russia. But this would mean that they have to basically lobby Washington that the Treasury Department allows European companies who do business with Iran to still operate in the United States. That, in other words, the United States Treasury would not sanction European companies for doing business with Iran. If they can secure those guarantees, it is possible that this agreement, a parallel agreement just between Iran and the European powers, would be reached.
With the angry response from Iran's spiritual leader, will the president's decision to leave the JCPOA put the hardliners in Iran in the ascendancy?
No question about it. I mean, already they were in a bit of an ascendance in that the economic returns that had been promised as part of the JCPOA were slow in the coming. The hardliners had used this against President Rouhani and his foreign minister Javad Zarif to say that the Americans were basically executing their end of the deal in bad faith, that the U.S. Treasury was slow in granting exemptions to American companies through their European subsidiaries to do business with Iran, and that the United States still continue to sanction certain members of the Iranian elite, as well as Iranian companies that it deemed had connections with Iran's Revolutionary Guard. So from their standpoint, the United States was very much holding up its end of the bargain in bad faith. And they used this very effectively to basically isolate and harangue the sitting president to say that he was too trusting of the Westerners and of the Americans, that they in fact meant what they said. And in this, they're really particularly well-versed given the history, the sort of tortured history of U.S.-Iran relations going as far back to 1953.
With the reimposition of U.S. sanctions on Iran over its nuclear program, will this complicate relations with traditional trading partners like the Europeans, given their trade relations with Iran?
No question about it. The number one complication is that the United States now has to basically institute a very complex monitoring system to make sure that every company, every subsidiary of a U.S. company that might be based out of Europe is in compliance with the sanctions that they would like to put in place again. It's unclear just how effective this will be in practice, given the impact this would have on the U.S. economy, and given the sheer number of problems that the United States already has with Western Europe when it comes to other trade issues, such as steel and aluminum tariff, the withdrawal from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, etc. So it's unclear what this all will look like in practice, but there's no question that it would complicate things further.
One issue that very few people are talking about is the fate of several Americans currently detained in Iran. What of them?
This is going to heighten their anxieties or their families' anxieties about the possibility of them being used as bargaining chips even more. You can bet that they will be using them effectively to get as much leverage as possible out of the United States. It could also be a very dangerous flashpoint in that the Iranians may actually dig deeper and this time institute even harder sentences and more harsh conditions, political prisoners and dual nationals and American citizens that are in Iranian prisons. So all bets are off. It's particularly dangerous for that cohort.
That's Hussein Banai, Assistant Professor of International Studies at Indiana University. A bill just introduced to lawmakers in the U.S. House of Representatives is being called groundbreaking in a way that could radically bolster law enforcement and strengthen regulations to combat wildlife trafficking by enlisting and rewarding whistleblowers, among other things. Joining us now to find out more about this is Stephen Cohn, Executive Director of the National Whistleblower Center, one of the organizations endorsing the legislation. First of all, tell us specifically what this bill is and does.
The bill is the most important anti-trafficking legislation in a generation. It accomplishes three things. One, enhanced detection of wildlife trafficking. Two, enhanced enforcement. And three, all of the proceeds from the successful prosecutions of the traffickers must be reinvested into wildlife conservation programs. It's a perfect storm. Better detection, better enforcement, and the proceeds to benefit wildlife.
And so it's a bill that would have funding behind it. Is that the goal here, to be able to do this enforcement?
This bill, they're going to use whistleblowers and enhance and incentivize whistleblowers to detect the crime worldwide. And those whistleblowers can get a reward if there's a successful prosecution. Then they're making trafficking a RICO crime. RICO is the most powerful anti-corruption law. It to target racketeering and organized crime, very large penalties. And when the traffickers are found guilty and sanctioned, that money from the traffickers that must get reinvested into conservation. So the money for conservation comes from the criminal cases. And in other contexts where this type of approach has been used, tax evasion, government fraud, securities fraud, it has resulted in hundreds of millions of dollars in extra recoveries because the whistleblowers are the key to the detection.
How would this work, though, with nations that don't have strict trafficking laws?
The law permits the whistleblower from any country in the world to file claims here in the United States anonymously and confidentially. That is the best protection if you reside in a country without a good rule of law. Second, the conspiracy provisions of RICO are exactly what was needed to make the wildlife enforcement laws work. So if the smallest amount of wildlife is brought into the United States, ivory, illegal fish, that can be part of the conspiracy, resulting in indictments and prosecutions of everyone in the conspiracy, starting with the poacher in Africa, to the people who transport it into the United States, to the person who purchases it in New York or San Francisco. That the conspiracy provisions is what will really give this law tremendous worldwide application. The vast majority of trafficking, which is over $25 billion a year, in which the United States is a main recipient, that's all illegal. So there's so much illegal trafficking that our prosecutors and our whistleblowers will be very busy.
Is the United States one of the largest markets for trafficking, for wildlife trafficking?
Yes. The Government Accountability Office issued a report yesterday, on Monday, which found that the United States was one of the largest markets in the world for illegal wildlife. The numbers are staggering, by the way. Over 10% of all the wild caught fish sold in America is illegal. People use illegal netting that destroys coral reefs. They kill protected fish when they're catching other types of fish, or they're bringing in species that are on the endangered species list. Then you have over 1,000 species of animals on the red list for near extinction. And the poaching of these animals is really out of control. 30,000 elephants illegally poached per year. And a lot of that ivory ends up in the United States.
Where does this bill go from here before it actually can become law, and how confident are you that it will pass?
If people support it, it will become law. We have very strong bipartisan support for this bill. The bill is logical. It is absolutely needed to stop the current extinction crisis. So we have the formula that's necessary to get this bill into law.
That's Stephen Cohen, Executive Director of the National Whistleblower Center. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, as Burundi prepares for a May 17th referendum to extend President Pierre Nkurunziza's time in office, it battles allegations of harassment committed against perceived opponents of the referendum. Critical times in Burundi on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. Veteran U.S. Central Intelligence Agency operative and current deputy director Gina Haspel vowed before lawmakers Wednesday that she would not renew a program of ruthless interrogations, an issue that has become a potential obstacle to her quest to lead the spy agency. In 2002, Haspel oversaw a secret CIA prison in Thailand, where detainees were subjected to waterboarding and other harsh interrogation techniques, frequently denounced as torture. Haspel testified before the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee in a confirmation hearing that centers on her role in carrying out the agency's interrogation program and possibly covering it up.
I can offer you my personal commitment, clearly and without reservation, that under my leadership, on my watch, CIA will not restart a detention and interrogation program.
Well, joining us now to talk more about this is former CIA officer Jack Rice. So, Jack, what's your reaction to this nominee and the hearing so far?
The idea that you have somebody who's the former DDO, the Deputy Director of Operations, somebody who actually runs the operations. I like the idea of having somebody at the helm who actually understands the CIA, somebody who isn't just a political. I like that. But the problem that I have with Gina Haspel is this. She has been fundamentally involved in the torture program. She instituted it. She was neck deep in it when we talk about what was going on in Thailand, but she testified to something which really made my blood chill. And she said she would not support, and I quote, she would not support a change in the law. This was missed by everybody. What it means when she says she would not support a change in the law is she wants to keep torture on the table as an option if the president wants it. The problem in this case is President Trump has already said not only does he support torture, not only does he support waterboarding, he supports a whole lot worse. The president says he supports a whole lot worse. The combination of those two side by side are petrifying to me.
What do you mean she's not in favor of changing the law? The law, it's illegal to torture.
No, it's not. It's not. Because technically what we have is there was not a change in the law when it comes to the issue of torture. What we had was an agreement that basically came down that everybody said we weren't going to do it anymore. The president said we wouldn't do it. Congress said we wouldn't do it. But there wasn't a fundamental process to go through that said we wouldn't do X, Y, and Z.
You're saying it's not illegal to torture?
No, President Obama.
I thought we abide by the Army Field Manual, which is strictly opposed to torture.
That's correct, so long as there is a definition of what it means. If you note, the difference was is we didn't go through the process to say it's illegal to waterboard. We didn't do that because what this actually does, this allows for a slippery definition of what torture is, which is exactly what we did after 9/11. And that's exactly what President Obama continued to allow. So the problem that we have right now is we never went through the process to say no. Now, maybe that's because President Obama would never have been able to get this through a Republican House. He would never have been able to get this through the Senate, potentially, and ultimately signed into law. But what it really does is it allows for flexibility. It could be reinstituted in the future rather than having to pass a law that says that it's okay, because we never passed a law that said that it wasn't. And in the past, we've said that it was.
What exactly was her involvement in this program?
It appears that if anybody was the chief of operations in country, and specifically as it applies to this, it was her. So in other words, she would have been the one to make the call here. And if we think about what happens if you have somebody who is a line case officer, which is what I was with the DDO, if you're the head of the Central Intelligence Agency, the DCI, if you're the DDO, the Deputy Director of Operations, which is kind of number two in the agency, you're the one who's actually making those decisions, and you're the ones making recommendations to Congress because you're the expert. You're the person who comes in the room and says, we should do X, Y, and Z. And my concern here is that while she is saying we shouldn't be doing this, she's also saying we shouldn't change the law, which means do we keep that option open to us? I think that's exactly what it means. There's a whole lot of reasons why torture is a bad idea, not just the moral question, but there's also the legal side of this. But the bottom line, and this is something that she said, which is it doesn't work. And bottom line, torture doesn't work, but it actually does something even worse than this, and that's something she didn't talk about, is that it provides false leads. It provides false intelligence, which can drive those people who desperately need that information down false paths. It can slow things down. It can destroy other operations. It can make things worse. And that's something that I think we have to talk about, because at the end of the day, it's about trying to get the job done at the same time as remembering who we are as a people. If we can't do both, we've got a very serious problem. And my fear is that this nominee may not see those distinctions, and I think anybody who's going to head the CIA needs to.
All right, former CIA officer Jack Rice, we appreciate your perspective as always. Well, facing social and legal hardships when she tried to end her marriage, an Egyptian woman decided to launch an online radio program to help others going through the same experience. 8 years later, the program continues to generate good advice. As VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo reports, its share of criticism as well.
Mahassen Sabur, founder and host of Radio Divorces, points out she created the platform to help other women who face the same difficulties she did.
We tried to rehabilitate the divorced woman. We tried to rebuild her psychologically and within society by telling them about what's available, including government services such as the National Council for Women and Child Centers.
She launched the online program 8 years ago to challenge the social stigma associated with divorce in Egypt.
From my experience and readings, I know a woman has the legitimate religious right to get a divorce. The problem is not about divorce itself, it's about what happens after divorce.
But not everyone is thrilled about the show. On the streets of the Egyptian capital, one resident says the program encourages women to seek divorce even after a small dispute.
When you see a woman who is liberated and calls for divorce and how beautiful it is and praises living without a husband, this deepens the wound of Arab families. We do not want to reach that level.
But another woman who went through a divorce defends the program's relevance.
Women are not only half the society, women are the entire society. She raises the minister, police officer, engineer, and the president. If she is psychologically stable and lives well, she will raise better generations.
Despite limited resources, about 36 volunteers provide technical assistance to the nonprofit forum. Sabr's co-host Mai Ali says the program caters to the needs of other people as well.
It is concerned with the whole family, how to raise your child, and even for single women, we provide advice on how to choose your life partner and how we can be more positive in our life.
The program is also timely. The divorce rate is said to be rising in Egypt, with nearly 200,000 cases in 2016, a 10% increase from 2015, according to the country's Central Agency for Public Mobilization and Statistics. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, as always, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Preparations for a landmark meeting between President Donald Trump and North Korea's dictator Kim Jong-un to discuss the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula are ongoing. Success in achieving that goal would, as President Trump has said, be a great achievement for the world. The U.S. has made clear that until North Korea takes concrete, permanent, and verifiable steps to end its nuclear weapons program, sanctions remain in place and the maximum pressure campaign will continue. The U.S. has also made clear that it has other grave concerns with North Korea, chief among them the Kim regime's horrific record on human rights. April 28th to May 5th was North Korea Freedom Week, a week organized by NGOs in South Korea as well as the international community to promote the freedom and human rights of the North Korean people. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert issued a statement on the occasion of North Korea Freedom Week, challenging the world not to forget the millions of North Koreans who continue to suffer under one of the most repressive and abusive governments in the world. For more than 60 years, the people of North Korea have faced egregious human rights violations in virtually every aspect of life, Ms. Nauert said. In addition to the roughly 100,000 individuals, including children and family members of the accused, who suffer in political prison camps, North Koreans face an almost complete denial of fundamental freedoms by their government. Those trying to flee this oppressive environment, if caught, are often tortured or killed. The United States, said spokesperson Nauert, remains gravely concerned and deeply troubled by these abuses. In tandem with the maximum pressure campaign, we will continue to press for accountability for those responsible. We are also going to continue our efforts to increase the flow of independent information into, out of, and within this isolated state to present everyday North Koreans with a more realistic picture of the outside world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
From Washington.